Happy Valentine's Day, my love.
How are you, lover? Will you hold my hair while I vomit?
Can I give you a chalky candy heart that says be mine, or perhaps a box of Andy's candies?
You almost had to do that when we met in Ottawa, because I was sick as a dog, and I'm like, who's gonna be here to hold my hair if I throw up in the lobby of the Marriott? It's going to be Wish!
Valentine's Day was always a trip for me when I was a kid, because, like, it was such a big deal in school. It became almost like, you know how, like, at Christmas time, there's always competition to do Christmas cards the right way? Like, whoever's got the coolest Christmas card. If you have a kid, it becomes almost like this unspoken competition with your friends to have, like, the cutest, aw, baby, picture on your Christmas card. When it was Valentine's Day in school, there literally was competition to come up with who was going to have the better box of store-bought, mass-produced Valentines to give out to people in class. And I remember, I'd go in and thinking that I'd get it one, right, that I had, like, the coolest Valentine, and then someone would give me, like, an Ultimate Warrior Valentine on my desk and be like, shit, well, I just got trumped.
He had a roided-up Valentine? You know, it was never – Valentine's Day was never a big deal, at least not where I grew up in the West End of Toronto. Halloween was the big deal. And everybody tried to trump each other on costumes every year.
That was always
the big one. But I can't remember Valentine's Day ever being a really big thing. And maybe it's just because it's never been a big thing in my life per se. I'm not the most romantic kind of guy, yo. But I've never remembered Valentine's Day being a big deal. And you know what? Is this true? Historians in the audience hit me on this one. Is Chris Valentine the only Valentine to ever play in the National Hockey League? Former Washington Capital, went on to become a legend playing in Germany. His daughter is Mandy Valentine. She's a Canadian figure skater. But to your recollection, Wish, has there ever been another Valentine that played hockey in the NHL? Chris is the only one that I've ever heard of.
I can't think of one.
I think that's it.
But if your last name is Valentine, you got to wear number 14, right? I mean, that's
totally
pretty much guaranteed, right?
Come on, that's an easy one. Let me do a quick little. Hold on, standby caller.
This is fun. Now we're both. This is the speed of the internet connections.
La la la.
No, he wore number 20.
Dude wore 28.
He's wore 28. I got there first.
Damn it.
Stupid now, laptop.
Maybe was 14 taken in 1981 by the someone on the Washington Capitals. Here we go again. Hang on a second.
I'm not going down that level. I'm not following you down that rabbit hole, DiCaprio.
Come on,
from
man.
Inception.
You can do it.
All right. So happy Valentine's Day to everybody out there. And boy, what a joyous Valentine. The Valentine given to us as hockey fans today. It's better than a box of chocolates. It's better than caramel-filled chocolates that get stuck in your teeth and make your gums hurt. Valentine that was given to us today as hockey fans was a Rick Nash trade possibility for the deadline. No longer will we have to sit idly by and talk about the destination of Sammy Paulson or chat up Hal Gill like he's the second coming of Doug Harvey. Now we'll actually have an actual superstar on the trade block at the trade deadline, thanks to the Columbus Blue Jackets, Merrick.
Yeah, it is Rick Nash, as rumored for a few weeks now, and that has now come out more so as the days dwindle until the February 27th trade deadline, and the hours get shorter. It has become more and more obvious that while perhaps not actively going out and shopping Rick Nash, at least we know now this guy, and Rick Nash has a no movement, so he's driving this thing to begin with. At least Scott Housen is listening to offers for Rick Nash. You know, the most interesting thing to me is, and perhaps the most revealing thing out of all of it is, when Scott Housen
Jeff Carter didn't turn out as a good centerman for Rick Nash.
Well, there is that too. How'd you like to be Carter right now too, if Rick Nash gets moved and Jeff Carter ends up standing there holding the bag?
He's like, wait a second, this was supposed to be me. I was supposed to be the guy that was going to play himself out of town. This is bullshit.
Out like this? But when Scott
Housen...
What's
the most fascinating thing?
Well, 2 weeks ago, John Shannon, who first, I think, approached the story on Hockey Central Saturday, when he asked Scott Housen about it, the comment was, I don't make comments on trades. And now that the Rick Nash wins have blown higher, harder, faster, stronger, he continues to the march to the beat of the same drummer. I'm not commenting. Scott Housen, this is your franchise player. Scott Housen, this is your captain. Don't you owe at least a franchise player, if you are indeed not shopping him, to say, no, he's not going anywhere? Which leads us all to believe the inevitable, and that this guy is being shopped. This guy is going to
here. Well, here is the latest from Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch, a man who is as plugged in can be. This is last week, the Blue Jackets brass, owner John P. McConnell, President Mike Priest, Scott Housen, Senior Advisor Craig Patrick, Interim Coach Todd Richards, and perhaps others, met to discuss the club's plans as it heads towards the deadline. In that meeting, it was determined that the possibility of trading Nash needs to be explored. In the days that followed, the Blue Jackets met with Nash and or his agent Joe Resnick, where the plan was presented. Nash, who has a no-movement clause for this season and the three following seasons, would have to approve any trade. Clearly, he said, go ahead and kick the tires. I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Here's
Cedric Nash today, Cedric Nash today, Sportsline. Quote, I'm a Blue Jacket right now. I've played my whole career here, and it's a special place to me. So as of right now, I'm a Blue Jacket. Take a drink every time he says right now. God.
Stating the obvious. Look, he wants to go. I think he's had enough. He knows there's another rebuild on the horizon. He's 26 years old. And listen, Wish, as we talked about in this program, 2 weeks ago, he doesn't want to be Ryan Smith. He doesn't want to be the guy that, you know, goes to the International Ice Hockey Federation Hall of Fame. He doesn't want to be the guy that wins the World Championship every year or competes in the World Championship every year on behalf of Team Canada. He doesn't want to be the new version of Captain Canada. He wants to win Stanley Cups. And I think he's looking at the Columbus Blue Jackets situation and saying, uh-oh, it's going to be another teardown rebuild. Do I want another 5 years of that? This will put me at the age 31 or 30. Is he 27 or 26? And that'll make me 31 or 32 years old. Do I really have the appetite to go through this all again? If I'm Rick Nash, the answer has to be no. But then the question becomes, who's the highest bidder for Rick Nash?
Well, that's not the question. The question isn't who's the highest bidder. Like, the Edmonton Oilers were the highest bidder for Danny Heatley. Danny Heatley and an Edmonton Oiler. I mean,
From where he wants to play, i.e. Cup contenders.
That's what's tricky about it. I mean, that's why today is so much fun. Like, everybody and their mom is coming up with trade proposals for Rick Nash. Like, I was reading a Minnesota Wild blog that came up with a trade proposal for Rick Nash. Rick Nash isn't even visiting Minnesota in the next 5 years, let alone playing for the Wild. I mean, come on, honestly, he's not going to play. He's going to go to a select few teams.
Hang on. You're telling me he doesn't want to go play with Zach Parise in Minnesota?
Oh, sorry, you're a bastard. Now you're just trying to be mean.
Sorry, bro.
I think he's got a select few teams in mind. And the real interesting thing about Nash is that it's almost like when we talked about Brad Richards last summer. The thought about Nash has always been that he finds Columbus to be quaint. It's a great place. He can be himself. He's the big fish in a small pond. Never really said, oh, my God, I wish I was playing in Toronto because of the hustle and bustle and people treating me a different way.
But he did say, after he signed the 8-year ticket, he did say, yeah, sorry to all those people that thought that I was going to end up in Toronto, but my heart is in Columbus.
So he liked Columbus a lot.
That referenced the idea that, you know, Toronto was sort of on the radar for him. And it's funny because my Twitter right away, as soon as it became obvious that Rick Nash was available, much like yours, here come the trade proposals. I don't think the Maple Leafs have anywhere close to the amount of assets that it would take to get Rick Nash. Like, I would be stunned. You know who I think, you know where I think he ends up?
Well, there's a couple teams, but this is where you think he's going to end up. Not necessarily who has the best offer, but where he's going to end up.
I think it would be the best offer too. Like, if I'm Scott Housen, and that's another question too. If you're John McConnell, you want Scott Housen driving the bus on this deal?
I think the fact that the brass met and they've all come to this conclusion and operative phrase, senior advisor Craig Patrick, aka the guy who made the Ron Francis trade, is in the room. You know what I mean? Like, I have a feeling that Housen is, they're not going to fire Housen now. It's pointless. What's the point of firing him now? They'll fire him in the summertime. I think he is merely the front man for whatever deal is made.
Then you don't make a deal with Nash right now. You say, Scott, you're not making this deal right now. You wait till the offseason, then you do something with him. How about
this? But the value could be higher now than it'll be at the draft.
Maybe. Maybe. Well, we see what the offers are, right? Because a lot of teams won't have the cap space right now.
Well,
that's another big consideration.
What's the team that you thought was going to go to? Where is he going?
If I'm Scott Housen, I'm talking to Peter Chiarelli. And there are two players that I'm talking about. And it's a tough one for the Boston Bruins, but you got to give if you want to get. if you're the Boston Bruins, do you do this deal? Rick Nash for Tyler Seguin and Tuukka Rask.
If you're the Boston Bruins?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, listen, you got to give if you want to get. It ain't going to be, no, hey, we'll give you a Colbert, Kadri and a first. It ain't going to be one of those.
If I were the Boston Bruins, the first thing I'd, you know what? Let me repackage this for a second, because I don't want to trade Seguin necessarily. Right. What if I offered Krejci, McQuaid, and Rask for Nash? Does that get it done?
Krejci, McQuaid. No, I want Tyler Seguin in this deal. I like Rask, but I want. Okay, well then I'll move on to the Vancouver Canucks then. Thank you.
That's a big fat cap hit.
And we'll talk about Corey Schneider and Cody Hodgson in Vancouver. Yeah. All you need is two teams, man. And you want Rick Nash? Like, you want Rick Nash? Like, on a good team, Nash is bank it, 40 goals. Bank it. He's a beast, big horse coming down the wing. And if you're the Boston Bruins and Nathan Horton's in the lineup, Nathan Horton's out of the lineup, he's another big body that fits the mold of the Boston Bruins. Damn, I know it stings. Rask and Seguin?
What do you think about the Rangers in this scenario and their interest? Does that make any sense to you?
It depends what they're offering. I don't think the thing that I saw online last night with Chris Kreider and Brandon Dubinsky, mm-hmm. not even close, not even in the same ballpark. Of what you're not going to steal Rick Nash, all right?
No,
that to me is theft.
That's the salient point out of all this. Like, I feel like people have just taken their Bobby Ryan trade proposals and just inserted Rick Nash's name. You know what I mean? Like, the level of compensation for Rick Nash is a star. Rick, these players don't remember. The Kovalchuk thing was a different situation. That was a deadline move. He was going to be an unrestricted free agent, and then he left. You know, he was going to leave. That was a different deal. This guy is under contract for quite a long time. This is a guy that could be the cornerstone of your team for quite a long time.
Six more years, or is it seven more years for Rick Nash? Is this year one or two?
I think it's 2018, I want to say.
So, yeah, you got this guy wrapped up. You know, this guy is not facing free agency. I mean, this guy is wrapped, and I'm telling you, healthy with a good centerman that can dish and not shoot first like Jeff Carter does. This guy is bank it, 40 goals. That's why my first turn is to the team that has the assets and has the cap space going forward. To me, the deal is there to be made with the Boston Bruins. That to me just seems like the obvious one. It's going to be painful. I understand that. You're not going to get him, for Zach Hamill, two firsts, Adam McQuaid, and David Krejci. You're not going to get him for that. You're going to get.
Could
it's
you get
gonna,
him for?
It's going to be
could,
opening oh, bid well, for Tyler Seguin.
Could you? Tyler could Seguin. You get him for? Could you get him for Krejci, Dougie Hamilton, and Rask?
I'd still want.
I think that's a package that lands Rick Nash, personally.
Krejci,
top line
Dougie
center,
Hamilton,
blue chip. Build your defense around this cat defenseman and a goalie that you can start.
Pretty good.
That's a pretty good. Now the team.
Yeah,
now I think the Rangers are going to be in the mix. I've heard from Capitals fans that they don't think the Caps are going to be in this thing. But honestly, logically, the Caps have assets to trade. They have a guy making $6.7 million against the cap right now, which is 1.1 less than Nash in seven.
And he's gone.
So you're basically putting Nash into that salary slot. It gives you a second. I mean, you're talking all the time about Ovechkin and what does Ovechkin need, and then you talk about taking the pressure off of Ovechkin, putting Rick Nash on another scoring line. Now the thing with Nash though is that he's not a self-starter. He needs a center, and the Caps don't unless you're going to play him with Backstrom, and then play Ovi with someone else. Which isn't the worst, because I've heard that Ovechkin and Backstrom aren't exactly BFFs these days, so it may not be the worst idea in the world. I don't know if it's the right move for the Capitals, but I don't think that you can discount them as a suitor.
No, I don't think you can discount them. The one asset that everyone would be looking for out of the Washington Capitals that I think is gettable is Yevgeny Kuznetsov. Now, I know that the Columbus Blue Jackets have been through their share of Russian hockey players. Hello, Zhirdev. Hello, Filatov. And perhaps this year, hello, Neil Yakupov or Grigorenko. Having said that, Kuznetsov would have to be part of any package, don't you think?
That would be the
plus one of John Carlson and Carl Alsner, who, by the way, were on the ice for all five goals last night. Ouch.
Yeah, I mentioned, by the way, my fantasy casting for Nash is L.A., by the way.
Oh, yeah, what do they give up?
They've got the goalie, they've got Bernier.
Yep.
Maybe you send Jack Johnson the other way.
Wow. Okay. Uh-huh. I'm feeling that they'll want a forward though.
I don't know who the forward is. That's the problem. That's my issue right now, is I don't know who the forward would be. Jarrett Stahl ain't getting it done.
Nope. Justin Williams ain't.
Yeah. But LA is an interesting choice, and you know that Dean will be aggressive. This is going to be so much fun to see how this plays out. Not fun for all of our Columbus listeners necessarily, which brings me to one last point. And I know this is the longest opening segment probably in the history of the program.
And let me point out, because of you.
Thank you. We need to go here though.
All right.
Can the Blue Jackets as a franchise recover from a Nash trade?
That is an excellent question. I don't think it's one of those throw the keys on the table kind of moments, but it really is a tough one. And that's why you
when Kovalchuk left Atlanta, Atlanta left a year and a half later.
Yeah. But they were going. I mean, they were going anyway. Writing was on the wall there. I don't think Columbus is going anywhere. I just think this sets them back from. I mean, he's the face of the franchise. He is the Columbus Blue Jackets. How do you trade the face of the franchise unless you're bringing in someone else who acts as the de facto face of the franchise? See, or you already have someone there who has the face of the franchise, and they don't.
It'd be Yakupov, but then you're
rolling the dice that you're gonna end up with the number one overall pick in the lottery, and then you build around Neil Yakupov. Hey Columbus, get ready to get nailed. I mean, it's obvious. It's simple. It's beautiful.
Here's my take on that. I think as far as rebuilding the franchise, repairing the image, whatever you want to call it when you trade your franchise guy in a Rick Nash, it's less about what's coming back the other way than who you're installing in management and behind the bench. And I'll give you the best example. People forget that even though they had assets on the roster and they had the potential to be a very good team, the Tampa Bay Lightning were shit before Yzerman came and before Guy Boucher showed up. So you get the right people in place there. That's where the image rehabilitation happens. It ain't on the ice. It's on the guys in the organization. Like, hey, Dale Talon's a good example. Dale Talon being in that position in Florida is the reason they're as good as they are. He was able to recruit talent. He was able to make the Campbell trade. Campbell was then made the ambassador to bring in other guys.
Yep.
You need someone in management to be the guy who will turn the franchise around. It's not going to be what you get for Rick Nash necessarily. Those are going to be pieces to the puzzle, but you need some dude of some renown or some ability to put the pieces in place.
Which is why now the Columbus Blue Jackets have a wonderful opportunity now that it has become more and more obvious that Rick Nash is indeed in play. Jeff Carter's been in play for a while now. The only guy who's not in play is Vinny Prospal, who they love for some reason, and re-signed to another one-year deal, and are going to give him a handshake that he's going to get a job within the organization when his playing days are over. You have a great opportunity right now with those two players to redo your organization.
Yeah.
If it's done properly. If you can bring in some really good young pieces for the field. Like you can take a 5-year plan and make it a 3-year plan pretty fast when you're dealing with guys like Jeff Carter. I know the term isn't palatable for a lot of teams. When you're dealing with guys like Carter and dealing with guys like Nash, a 5-year plan can turn into a 3-year plan really quick. If it's done right, this thing can turn around quick. And I think if I'm the Columbus Blue Jackets, first place I'm looking is Boston, second place is Vancouver.
And now, 20 minutes.
Wow.
Into the show, we officially start the show.
Welcome. Welcome.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
That's a hockey, you know. It's only a game. Why do you have to be mad?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sedin is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Well, that's it for the show. I'm Jeff Merrick from Sportsnet.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna pull back the curtain here. What are you embarrassed about? We had a good discussion going. You're Mr. I Want Freeform Radio. Oh, I'm so tired of the constraints. I don't want to be the guy who has to do traffic and weather together on the eights. We've got this good discussion going, and you said you're effing embarrassed that we went as long as we did in the first segment.
So the way that now that Greg is breaking kayfabe here. The way that our program works, considering I'm in the west end of Toronto, Elena's at the Fan 590 studios in downtown Toronto. That's One Mount Pleasant, and Greg is in Virginia. The way that we communicate is through our G-chat, essentially. And so Elena's like Elena sends in this message, 18 minutes, congrats, we're setting a new record. And then she types in a minute later, just a 19, and she's just like counting down the clock. Greg types in, starting the show now, Elena, wow. And then I chime in, I'm effing embarrassed. And that
he's effing embarrassed.
Because I always get beaked for being the guy that makes the intro too long. Always. Because I got stupid stories. And hey, you want to hear a trade? And I got a story about this goofy guy. And I have a story from 1942. And here's a story about Maritimes hockey. So that's usually me. This time, you pick it up, Wish.
Coming back later in the program, by the way, we're going to have Peter Marr on the show to talk about milestones in his broadcasting career. Voice of the Calgary Flames, talking about a little bit of history, talking about the industry. Should be pretty good. Later on, we will have the second installment of our week-long series, which is the greatest trades that never happened, basically. The greatest trades never made, as we will revisit another one. One that may involve a player we talked about yesterday. And then question of the day, how do you fix the Washington Capitals? We'll get to this in a second, but that's the question. PuckDaddyBlog@Yahoo.com, @Wyshynski, @JeffMerrick on Twitter, #MVSW. Think about what are your ways and means to try to fix the Washington Capitals, who again lost last night to the San Jose Sharks, who again gave up, what, Merrick? A center ice goal.
Okay, do you want to do this? Okay, let's go back. And this is all, guys. This is all in the month of February, all right? February the 1st, Michael Samuelson, center ice goal against Michael Neufert. Okay. 8 days later, February 9th against the Winnipeg Jets, Dustin Byfuglien scores from center on Thomas Vokoun. And then last night, Dan Boyle takes the shot from just behind center. Joe Pavelski, just before the blue line, tips it. February 13th, it is the trifecta, the hat trick of long goals allowed by Washington Capital goaltenders. Braden Holtby lets it in to kick off the game yesterday. Not
looked
the best
terrible.
Start at all.
Looked terrible last night.
But you know what? I feel for him in that situation because, and J.C. Tremblay was the best at this. He said, flip the puck. I don't know why guys don't do this more. Just flip the puck in front of goaltenders and then watch it bounce in. That puck was skipping stones. Like, honestly, as a tactic, J.C. Tremblay was the best. Jim Dorey would do it out of his own zone, never towards the opposition net. But J.C. Tremblay was the finest for just, you know, wish like getting over center and arcing the puck so it lands right in front of the goaltender and you have no idea how it's going to bounce. It's like a really smart play, and I have no idea why players don't do it anymore. Just flip it in and let it bounce in front of the goalie. Dude, it's a hot potato, and weird things happen. Anyway, that's what happened last night to Braden Holtby. Today he got sent back down to Hershey.
So we'll talk about the Caps in a second or two, but first, let's address something that was said on the NBC Sports Network last night. Our good friend Mike Milbury, who we should really have. You know, I was thinking the other day, we haven't really done an adversarial interview yet. We haven't had Proto on. I'd like to have Milbury on at some point. I don't know if they'd come on. It's like it'd be a handicap match.
I worked with Mike for 4 years. I like Mike. I get along with Mike.
Do you think Mike would come on with you?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I think Mike would for sure.
I don't know if Mike likes me. I don't think he likes. He said something about me at one point on the air, and I forget what it was. He called me out. But I think I think Milbury is good for business. Like I think the world needs curmudgeons, and the world needs guys that are going to say. The guys are going to say the kind of bullshit you're about to hear. Here's Mike Milbury last night after Eric Staal elbowed Thomas Plekanec in the head.
It was an elbow. And, you know, there's been a history of this.
You want your captain to do come back
I don't know
out.
If you want
well,
him
we
to elbow.
See, we, yes, I do, Jonesy.
No,
I do want
don't.
Him to. I do.
You,
don't tell me what I want. You, I want him to elbow the guy in the head. After what we saw with Skinner, they were running Skinner. You saw the guys take shots at Skinner. Nobody did anything until the captain goes out and does it.
First off, hell of an audition for a head coaching gig here in the NHL for Milbury right there. I think that was really well done. I'm sure he got about 10 or 15 phone calls last night from GMs asking about his services. You want your captain to elbow other players in the head. Now, it should be said that again, it's a classic. It's a classic Milbury moment. It's a classic Milbury moment because the play at center ice was they're both going for the puck. Stahl. Yeah, right. And Eric Stahl. Stahl elbows Plekanec in the head, right? And then Plekanec takes just this horrendous flop. I mean, it was a flop. It sucked that he got elbowed in the head. I'm not saying he wasn't hurt, but it was a flop. And it was a classic Milbury moment in the sense that he's the only guy in the panel calling a flop, but yet at the same time rationalizing a guy getting elbowed in the head.
I know what Mike was doing. He was going, this was all hyperbole, right? Do you think Mike Milbury believes a guy should run around and target each other's heads with elbows?
Yes!
No, he doesn't.
Of course he does!
No, he does. Yes, he wants caveman hockey. Ooga booga.
This is not a bit. You really think that he believe, you think he wants people to be elbowed in the head?
His point was that after the Montreal Canadiens took liberties with the smallest player on the ice of either team, Jeff Skinner, that was an appropriate response for a captain. You're going to go after our guy, we're going to go after yours. You want to be nasty, we can be nasty too. And if that means an elbow to the head, so be it. And I understand that.
You talk about him being Neanderthalic. Well, that's Neanderthalic in 2012, is the notion that the best way to get comeuppance about a guy, another team taking liberties with one of your guys, is to go and chicken wing some dude unsuspectingly at center ice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not cool anymore. You can't do that anymore.
Well, fine, but there are still plenty of people. And you know what? I count myself as one of them. Let's say that the policing is best done on the ice by the players. And when you start to remove fear from the equation in a contact flow game like hockey, even more dangerous things will happen. I guarantee you.
Let's dial it back for a second, the
culture of hockey is played in North America. Once you remove fear from someone, once someone feels that they are not responsible for their actions and they can do anything and there are no consequences other than the smack on the wrist that they're going to get either from the referee or from supplemental discipline, once you remove fear, then really dumb things will happen out there.
But let's dial it back.
And
for
it was
a second.
Barely what, an elbow, too. He barely nudged him. Like,
He took a flop. He took a flop. Oh. But let's dial it back for a second here, okay? What Milbury is essentially arguing, though, is that he wants his captain to elbow people in the head to get revenge for things that have happened in the game. And when Keith Jones had the audacity to say, "You really believe that?" He's like, "Don't tell me, brah, 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 brah," is what he said.
I don't take it as literally as you do. Honestly, I don't. That's it. That's
amazing. Oh, I know it's an act.
That is an act, and that is done. That is done for effect, and the point that he's trying to make is all based in hyperbole and exaggeration.
The problem I've always had with Milbury is that if it's hyperbole, whatever it is, it's like an onion. You peel away a few layers, and what do you get? You get stink. It's every argument this guy makes. You peel away a few layers, and you realize that logically it falls apart. Logically, how could you argue that it's best for your team if your captain risks taking a 5-minute major for elbowing at center ice? How do you possibly rationalize that?
See, we see the point being two different things. I don't see the point being, yes, I want my captain to go out there and take 5-minute elbowing majors. The point that I think Mike was trying to make, or what I got from the conversation, is you want your captain sticking up for the team. You want your captain to say, hang on, okay, you're gonna take runs at Jeff Skinner. I'm gonna stick it right back to you. And if it's nasty, well, too bad. Then don't take shots at our guys. That to me is Mike Bilber saying this is how a captain behaves. You're just focusing on the one specific act. I'm taking it as a metaphor for how you want your captain
but
to behave.
But you can't divorce the act. He's using that act as a pivot for his entire argument, and the act would, in theory, take his best offensive player off the ice for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
Do you want your captain to fight? It's the same argument.
Yeah, it's called an investment penalty. Right? These are penalties that are easy to kill off. It's true. Wish Chris Pronger made a career on investment penalties and investment suspensions. And how many times have you seen a guy say, man, if they did that to me on the ice, I'd take a 15-gamer right there. They're investment suspensions. It's called the cost of doing business in the NHL.
Yeah, but it's also called your job as a defenseman is to intimidate. It's the reason you're out there. It's the reason you're supposed to make people cower in the crease. Eric Stahl's job is not to do that. Eric Stahl's job is to put the goddamn puck in the net. It's a completely different thing.
And true, but at the same time, too, and this may be a failing of the general manager and the team in general, they don't have someone to go out there that can straighten guys out. They don't have any. I'm not talking about going and getting a gorilla, but I'm talking about they don't have a Brandon Prust out there. They don't have a David Clarkson. These guys are rare commodities now in the National Hockey League, and that's why you hold on to them sacred like a child. The Carolina Hurricanes don't have that guy. They don't. It's true. It's the most now that the gorilla is leaving the game, guys like Clarkson are so valuable, dude. So valuable.
And then we put David Clarkson in swaddling clothes.
Okay, I was going a little overboard there. I was going a little overboard too.
All right, before we get in the spirit of the thing. Before we get Peter on the phone, Washington Capitals, sir. So I'm getting a lot of questions about the Caps, about what they're going to end up doing at the deadline. Clearly, they're a team that needs a kick in the ass. I've at full strength. The one glaring hole that I think they've always had is that second line center. They addressed it last year with Arnott. I expected they would address it again. Maybe they try to do something more spectacular. But again, the issue with the Caps is this. Mike Green hasn't played since January 7th.
Yep.
Nicholas Backstrom hasn't played since January 3rd.
Yep.
It's very, very hard to justify slamming down the panic button, making a huge trade when you have two of your top three players out of the lineup.
I agree, and that's why there isn't, you know, you could do the knee-jerk reaction trade and blow some things up and tear some pieces down just to remain respectable this season, because at the beginning of the year, a lot of people said, it's Washington's year. They're going to the Cup. I think the Hockey News picked them to win the Stanley Cup this year, and they weren't the only ones. But you're right. To me, the big one, and I've never been the biggest Mike Green guy. I like my defenseman to play a different way, but I do understand one thing. When he's in the lineup, that team wins. That's a huge one to me, more so than Backstrom, and even more so than the net money that they've received this year, or haven't received this year, rather. To me, the big one is Mike Green. They are just, the way that they play, the way that team can excel is to turn a 3-on-2 into a 4-on-2, and there are very few, if any, defensemen better at jumping up into the rush than Mike Green. To me, he is the big one. What do you do to fix the Caps? Send Mike Green to Lourdes and get him healthy and bring him back. That's how you fix the Washington Capitals.
He needs the Lazarus Pit is what he needs. They're 9-1. They're 9-1 when he plays this season. But that's it. You know, you've just described a team, though, that I'm not sure it exists. I think the other beyond the injuries and beyond some little tweaks that have to happen here and there on the roster, my big thing with the Capitals at this point is I don't know if they know who the F they are anymore. I feel like the players in this roster have been jerked back and forth so many times. Oh, play fire wagon. No. You can't win like that in the playoffs. Play defensive. No. Open it up again. I feel like these guys have no identity. And maybe it does tie back into the fact that Ovechkin hasn't been Ovechkin, is no longer the big catalyst for this team, or when he is the catalyst, it's very inconsistent. I just feel like when I see this team night in and night out, they don't know what they're supposed to be anymore.
That is a great point. This team has been false started a number of different times, and this is not about the coach. In a lot of ways, this is not even about the players, but it is about the general manager who put this collection of players together and put them in this room. And see, here's my thing about the Washington Capitals, and we all have we all have our dreams, we all have our wishes, we all have our hopes. I really wanted the Washington Capitals 3 years ago to win the Stanley Cup. You know why? Because I wanted that style of play to be rewarded. Like, right. I wanted the 1980s style Edmonton Oilers. If you score 6, we're going to score 7. I wanted that type of hockey to be rewarded because every year, every general manager apes that which is successful from the year before. That's why I wanted that to work. And that's why the Capitals, you know, were so much fun to watch. It was the most exciting team in the NHL, period. Who didn't love watching the Washington Capitals? Unfortunately, that's great for 82 games, but the puck is heavier in the playoffs. And the checking is tighter, and it's a grinding game. And you're talking about, oh, here comes that guy again. He just dumped the puck into my corner. And last time I went back and fetched it, and he was there, it didn't tickle. Do I really want to do this again? To me, this is all about the players that the general manager has put into the dressing room. It's not necessarily about those guys specifically, but it's just that there are too many guys that play the exact same way on that team. And that's great for 82 games of the season, but in order to be successful in the playoffs, you need to break that and do something different. And that's a team that hasn't evolved.
How do you feel about this being the waning days of Mike Knuble in Washington, by the way? Healthy scratches, Boston. Basically I need to move on.
I hear Boston. Is that what you're hearing too? I keep hearing Boston from Mike Knuble.
That'd be a good to fill the recce role.
Yeah, I think he's a deadline guy to go. I think so. And it's too bad, you know, because the Washington Capitals, I mean, you look at when did they turn things around last year, as HBO documented? Well, Mike Knuble got up in the dressing room and made that speech. Was it after the Boston game or after the Ottawa? Was it second period of the Boston game or the Ottawa game in mid-December? And it was Mike Knuble. Like, it was Mike Knuble didn't have the C on the jersey, but damn it, he was a captain, wasn't he? He was more so than Alexander Ovechkin, who just happened to wear the C on the sweater. It was Mike Knuble. Like, that was the guy that helped turn things around. I mean, more Knuble, less Ovechkin was the recipe for success for the Washington Capitals. Is this a dying days of Mike Knuble in Washington? Yeah, probably. I think he's gone come trade deadline. That's the piece to dangle out there.
Real quick before we get to our guest, by the way, we had the Chris Valentine discussion earlier about his number, right? He was number 28 for the Capitals. This is because Gaetan Duchesne was number 14 for the Washington Capitals when Valentine was a rookie. And this is an interesting point that we didn't think about, which is from Bradley Spies. Hey, guys, if you haven't already figured it out, 28 equals 2 times 14.
Yeah, I thought about that.
God, I love hockey numbers. I love backstories on hockey numbers. It's the greatest thing. It's the greatest thing ever.
Andrew Podnieks has a book about it out there. I got to pick it up and read it one of these days. Hey, let's get to our guest. He called his 3,000th game on Saturday, the Calgary Flames and the Edmonton Oilers. He is a fixture in hockey going back to 1977 on radio when he called the Toronto Maple Leafs on CKO and All News FMer. And this was perhaps the greatest moment in this broadcaster's career. Greg, let's go back to 1989, the Calgary Flames and the Montreal Canadiens. Take it away, Peter Marr.
To go here at the Montreal Forum. 5 seconds before Calgary will have its biggest celebration. And Al MacInnis in the penalty box will watch the remainder of the game from there. Over at the Flame bench, they are already getting into the celebrating mood. 5 seconds left, face off in the Canadian zone.
Awesome. I think what they're telling them is to let them win the face off and just pull out of there. Don't get involved in any altercations at all now.
And over at that Flame bench, there's all kinds of excitement going on there. Over at the penalty box, Jim Poplinski and Tim Hunter, not dressed tonight, have joined Al MacInnis. They've got their sweats on, and the Calgary Flames have won the Stanley Cup. We're the winners! We're the winners! Yeah, baby!
I love it, ladies and gentlemen. I call this 3,000th game on the weekend. Game number 3,001 is tonight against the Toronto Maple Leafs. He is a Hall of Famer, Foster Hewitt Memorial Award winner in 2006. A pleasure to welcome to the podcast, Peter Marr. Peter, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm pretty good, Jeff and Greg. My pleasure to be on with you this afternoon.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Boy, if Twitter was around for that call, you'd have half the world saying that's the greatest call of all time and half the world going, that guy's the biggest homer I've ever heard.
You know, some of that stuff I get embarrassed by. The Yeah Babies that I put on, and then that particular one when the Flames won the cup and put it in the win column. But a fan seemed to like it, so I guess I'll continue with it. But it, sometimes I think it goes beyond the line that I like. But anyhow, it's become tag phrases, so we'll carry on with them.
Now let me ask you about the Yeah Babies. I had heard, geez, Pete, this is years ago, that it came as you were, I think, maybe driving to the rink and you heard it in a Rod Stewart song. Is that true?
Yeah, that was in 1986 when the Flames and the Oilers were playing in the playoff series, the second round playoff series. The Oilers were big favorites going in. The Flames led the series 3-2, and the sixth game was in Calgary. And when I was driving to the game, there was a refrain in a Rod Stewart song that yelled out, "Yeah, baby." And when that came, I kind of put that into my memory bank and said, well, if the Flames win tonight, I may use that. And then they didn't get to use it that night since the Oilers won, and there was then a Game 7 in Edmonton a couple of nights later, and that was the first time that I used that Yeah Baby phrase.
That's awesome. That is so cool. How much prep goes into that? I mean, like when you're calling a bit, like say the Olympics, for example, like you go to call the Olympics, how much in the back of your mind are you like thinking of phrasing and thinking of that stuff? Like if such and such happens, I'm going to be prepared to say this.
Well, with me, like the yeah, baby phrase has become, you know, synonymous with me when there's something important of significance for the Flames. And in the case of the Olympics, when I got to broadcast the gold medal that that Canada won. So, I don't really, the only thing I worry about is missing the goal or missing the right guy getting it. Like, in for instance, at the Olympics in 2010 there in Vancouver, when Crosby got the goal, you always worry that, you know, going into the overtime, you're thinking, oh, I got to make sure I get the right guy. I got to make sure. So as it turned out, it was a pretty clean play with Ginla passing to Crosby and putting it in the net. But sometimes, you know, they get a shot from the point where there's a deflection and you're not sure who deflected and that sort of thing. So you're always worried about that, for me anyway, more than anything else in a key situation, because you know that it's going to get played over and over again and you want to make sure it's right.
Now, Peter, you've never missed a game, 3,000 games in a row. What's the closest you came to missing a game?
Well, you mentioned there's been a few times, obviously. I came close to missing one of the Olympics, the gold medal game for that matter, because I had the semifinal games were played on a Friday, and there were two games, and I broadcast both of them, and then by the end of the and it was fighting a cold at the same time, and that's always a situation. Anyway, by the end of the second game, I could barely talk, and after the game, my son was there and some friends and stuff, and they said, oh, let's go out and celebrate Canada's in the gold medal game and all. I said, well, you guys go out and have fun. I'm going to the hotel. I won't see you until Sunday. And I went back to the hotel, and I rested, and I drank as much water as I could and got myself and didn't talk to very many people unless I had to. And by Sunday afternoon, I was ready to go again. So that was one. There was one when I was with the Maple Leafs back in, I think it was my second year, the Leafs had a game in Toronto on Saturday night and then a game in Chicago on the Sunday. Well, when I woke up on the Sunday morning, I could barely talk. And in those days, there were no charter flights. You flew on commercials. So went to the airport to get the flight that would take me to Chicago for that game. But, wasn't sure whether I'd be able to perform or not, but fortunately for me, I never got to find out because the game got postponed by a snowstorm in Chicago.
Unbelievable.
So I got saved on that one. There was another one in Vancouver one night that came close, whereby getting on the bus with the players, they were saying hello and I could barely talk back. But it seemed the closer I got to game time, the stronger my voice got. So it didn't get to be anywhere close to what it is right now, but it was enough to get some words out and get through the 2.5 hours of where it was for the game. So those are a couple. There's been a few others as well, but I've been very, very fortunate and very, very, very blessed to have been able to go through all of these without calling in and saying I can't do it.
You know, this may sound like a weird question, but Peter, I think you know where I'm going with this one. You know, over the years, perhaps when you're starting to feel a cold coming on, how much has vinegar become your friend?
Yeah, that's something I learned from Ann Murray. I got to meet her one time.
Ann Murray?
Yeah.
Wow.
I got to meet her one time, and I said to her, I said, what do you do when you have to go out and perform on stage and sing when you have a cold? Because with me, when I'm broadcasting a game and you're talking 100 miles an hour and you're talking in a loud tone, the nose starts to run, and then my eyes start to water, and then pretty soon I can't say anything. And so she said what she did was take two little sips of vinegar before the show. And now it doesn't cure anything, but what it does is that it kills the mucus that builds up, and that is what causes your nose to run and your eyes to water as it goes on. So I've had that. I have a little bottle in my case that I take with me to every game. I don't use it very often, but only when a cold is coming on and it looks like I might need it. And I've told this to some other broadcasters, and they've gone out. I remember one night there was a broadcaster that was broadcasting a junior game against the Hitmen at the Saddle Dome, and I saw him in the morning, and I told him about the vinegar. So that night I happened to be at the game, so I went up to the booth, and he had those little pockets that you get at the concession stand. He must have had 15 of those all thrown around.
Vinegar.
When it got to be a commercial break, I said, that's a way too many. You're going to burn your stomach. You're going to burn your stomach and
amazing.
Your throat.
Well, you know, and Murray, huh? Sarah McLachlan once told me chamomile tea and don't keep dogs in cages. No, I'm kidding. I've never talked to Sarah McLachlan at all. The point is this.
Lozenges before a game or during a game because there's sugar in it, and that causes an issue too. So.
Oh, that's good advice.
This is all good stuff.
Hey, so
this is all good stuff.
you've been in this game so long. I was wondering about, so say, let's just take like the last 15 years, that chunk. How has broadcasting a hockey game changed in the last 15 years? Is there anything that kind of sticks out in your mind insofar as like, here is an extra task that I have to do during a game that I didn't have to do when I first started?
Well, there's more commercial liners. That's one thing that I have more of now than I used to have. It used to be in the old days you'd take a break for a commercial, and in those days on radio you didn't hear the commercials playing, so you had a stopwatch with you, so you'd time out the 30 seconds or whatever it was and hope that they got it started on time and you'd go right back at it. But there were never any liners to read. But now you've got a liner for a power play contest, you've got a liner for a penalty killer contest, you got a liner for this, liner for that. So there's more of those. The other part of it is that I have to do a lot more work on a game night, because nowadays there's pre-game shows and there's post-game shows since we're on all sports radio, whereby in the old days we're on music stations and our pre-game show would be about 15 minutes, so I'd prepare for about two interviews for that and then a post-game show just to wrap up the game. But now you need much more content, and so it keeps you around the rink longer, which is not a problem. But you do have to get more things done than you did in the past, because being on all sports, there's lots of time to fill.
You know, Peter, here's one, and this is a real compliment to you, and there's not a lot of guys that do this. And the radio call, as you well know, is much different than the TV call, where you can be a little more casual and that the pictures tell the story, where radio, you need to be a little bit more specific, but also you have to be a really good editor, and you have to know what's important at the time and what's not important at the time, because you could fill up so much for any given play. The one thing I've always admired about your call, and it might be a tiny little thing, but it means so much to someone's ears. Whereas a lot of broadcasters will say, I don't know, puck comes back to the point, Jay Bouwmeester puts a shot on goal. You'll describe whether it was a wrist shot or a slap shot, or a snapshot. Like, a tiny little thing like that really paints a picture. But I always do wonder, Peter, when you're calling a game, whenever I ask musicians, I say, how do you know when a song is over? I always ask play-by-play guys, how do you know what not to talk about during a play?
Well, I don't know. I guess it becomes, thanks for the compliment. I don't know. I mean, I really believe in painting the picture for the fan. And, I'm really cognizant of saying who has the puck and where it is. Like, if it's in the corner, Ginla has the puck in the right corner, passes back to the point on the right side, and, Bouwmeester shoots. And, I just think you need to paint the picture for the audience. Cause I remember, going back to when I, there were three of us that auditioned for the Maple Leaf job on CKO in 77. They had us come in for an exhibition game that the Leafs were playing against Montreal. We each got to broadcast one period. And I remember the few days later, afterwards, Ralph Mellenby, who was with Hockey Night in Canada at the time, he was helping CKO people in the selection for the broadcaster. And later I was talking to him. He said, you know, the biggest thing that you had going for you is that what we did when we were listening to the guys is that they had a table hockey game out, and they had a pointer, and they were using the pointer to show where the puck was based on what the play-by-play guy was saying. And he said, you were so strong in that area. He said that plus your enthusiasm were the two biggest things that you had going for you. So I've always remembered that, and wow. So that to me is a big key of painting that picture. I know I'll get tape recordings from junior broadcasters and college broadcasters and asking me to do a critique on it, and one of the things that I find with them is that you don't know where the puck is a lot of the time with them. And I think what happens is they've watched so many hockey games on television and listening to the play-by-play guy, where you don't have to paint that kind of a picture. The big thing is identifying who has the puck and building excitement that way. You don't have to say it's in the corner or along the boards or the blue line or that sort of thing. So that is one of the big things that I point out to them. And I guess as you go along, you get more experience with that. But that's the biggest focus I have when I'm broadcasting, is to make sure I'm telling the audience where the puck is and who's got it.
Well, it's fundamentals, right? I mean, like, it's no different than if somebody who cuts their teeth at a newspaper is going to be a better web writer or whatever. Like, I listen to Doc Emmerich on TV, and I feel like his radio roots come through. And I don't even know if the cat was on radio, but it sounds like he should have been, because his level of detail during plays when things get real chaotic, like when there's like five shots on goal in the span of 10 seconds, it's always so distinct and always so descriptive. I say to myself, this isn't coming from somebody who was who was brought up on television. It's coming from somebody who had to paint a picture at some point during his career that's different than simply being a television broadcaster.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you know, when I had a 3-year stretch there after I moved to Calgary in 80, I had a 3-year stretch where I'd go to Toronto when I could. My first commitment was to the Leafs, but I broadcast Leaf midweek games on Wednesday night on CHCH in Hamilton, who had the Leaf TV rights for midweek games. And so any Wednesday night the Flames weren't playing, I'd go to Toronto and or wherever the Leafs were and do the play-by-play on those games. And to remind myself that it was television and not radio, because I'd done so many radio games, was I'd take a piece of elastic and tie it on my finger with enough stress on it so I could feel it right through the entire game. And that would be my little hint that this is television, not radio.
That's funny. Hey, Peter, last one for me on this one. So obviously you've spoken to many, dozens, hundreds of Calgary Flames players through the years. Who's your favorite interview? Who's the guy that you'd light up when he'd hop on a post-game interview or a pre-game interview and say, okay, I know my work here is done because this guy is going to be pretty good?
Well, Bob Johnson was always the best. The late Bob Johnson, who coached the Flames for 5 years there in the mid-80s. He would interview Bob. There were a couple of things about him. One is that he liked to talk. So basically, I said to him one time, you know, I said just ask you one question, hand you the microphone, I'll walk up and get us a coffee, and by the time you're finished answering that question, I'll have the coffee for us. So he was really, and he was insightful. You'd ask him one question, he'd answer 10. But one time he answered a question, it was four, we timed it later, it was 4 minutes and 48 seconds. So I believe that's the longest that I've ever had an answer to a question in a broadcast, broadcasting anybody in the hockey world. So, you know, Bob was always, and he also had these superstitions that when we did the pregame, the coaches show was always recorded. And if the Flames were on a winning streak, we'd have to go to the spot where we did the last one. So in the Saddle Dome, the boiler room became the most popular place to go do the coaches show because that's where the most wins came from. So, and then there were other times where you had to do it in the penalty box. Remember one night in Vancouver, 2 hours before the game, Bob and I are walking across the ice at the old Pacific Coliseum, and both of us get up on the boards there on the ledge and climb over the glass because the penalty box door was locked. And we sit in there and do this show, and I'm thinking, boy, I hope nobody saw us do that. They're going to think we're crazy. So, and then, of course, we get out after and we'll open the door, walk across. So Jim Robson, who was the broadcaster for Canucks, and as I get up to the broadcast booth later, said, what were you and Johnson doing climbing over the glass to get in the penalty box? So it kind of lived, but that was Bob. And one time he had to go sit in the row of where the Flames win they were looking for that night. So if they were looking for the 30th win, we had to walk up 30 rows to find a seat to do the show. I said, I hope this winning streak doesn't last very long. I'm going to die walking up all these steps.
Hey, Peter, last one for me. I know you have a busy day calling the Maple Leafs Calgary Flames game this evening. There's a nice little bit of symmetry between when you were inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2006, winning the Foster Hewitt, and your 3,000th game on Saturday. Can you tell our listeners what you brought to the game?
Well, I brought with me in both of those instances the last handwritten letter I got from my mother, who passed away with Alzheimer's in 2005, and also the wristwatch from my father, who he gave to me when he passed away in 2006 in the month of March. So just by a short amount of time, he missed out on being part of that ceremony. So those are the two things that I wore had on me for the game on Saturday night, and also for the induction into the Hockey Hall of Fame is my way of remembering my mom and dad, and certainly they were an outstanding big part of my career in giving me all of the tools that were necessary to get things started at a very early age and then allow me to pursue my dream and starting at a young age. Let me talk on the radio while I was in high school. So and it just kind of went from there. So it was kind of unfortunate that they couldn't have been there that day in Toronto when the Hall of Fame ceremony was being held. But they're always in my heart and in my mind. Okay. And anything important, I'll have that with me.
And proud of their son. Peter, you're a wonderful man and a great broadcaster. Thanks so much for today. Have fun with game number 3001, and we look forward to 3,000 more games.
Well, if the snow keeps falling, I might not get there, but anyway.
Thanks, Peter. Take care.
All right,
enjoy the game today.
You know, Merrick might my dad listens to the show, so I will just say this right now. Dad, when I am inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame as a trailblazer in the blogging community, I promise that under my suit, because they'll make me wear a suit, under my suit I will wear your White Castle Belly Bombers t-shirt as a tribute to you, sir. Even with the pit stains, I will wear that shirt, and it will be...
You know what? I have a dad connection as well with Peter Marr. Because remember the story that I told a little while
Peter
ago?
Peter Marr's your dad?
Oh, Peter Marr is your father? Whoa, it's big swerve.
Jeff Barrick.
When I was a
kid... I'm your father. Oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby.
That's a Darth Vader moment. When I was a kid, on Saturday nights, I could stay up and watch all three periods of hockey. Hockey in Canada, I could watch all three. Yay, stay up late. But during the midweek, my mom would make me go to bed after the second period. So what my dad would do is he'd take a little radio and tune it in to CKO, which is an all-news FM station. Before that, it was CKFH, where the Maple Leaf games were, between 77 and 1980. He'd put it underneath my pillow. And I'd listen to the third period of the Maple Leafs game. And so the play-by-play voice that I sort of grew up with, well, for third periods anyhow, was Peter Marr. He was my guy when I was a kid. He was a play-by-play voice for your Toronto Maple Leafs, Peter Marr. And that's why every time I get a chance to talk to him, it's always special, because that guy is inextricably linked to my youth.
You and I both have a boner for radio. That's why we do this every day.
And totally.
I had the same experience. Like, I had my dad's transistor radio, this little handheld thing with a dial on the side. I would put that under my pillow, and I wouldn't listen to play-by-play necessarily, but I would listen to sports talk radio. I'd listen to WFAN in New York. And literally from, you know, the time I go to sleep, I would try to stay up late. Katie Baker, if she's listening, and I have a lot in common when it comes to a gentleman by the name of Steve Summers in New York. He used to host the midnight to 6 a.m. show on WFAN. FAN was cool because they actually had local hosts from the midnight to 6 slot instead of playing like syndicated stuff or just going off the air. And I used to put the radio under my pillow and just listen and just have that maybe take me to sleep, maybe make me stay up. It's the most wonderful experience to just be in a darkened room and it's you and a voice. And that voice is carrying you, and it's just fantastic. Can we get to a couple things before we close out the show today.
Raise one point,
please,
really quickly.
We
played the clip. Atlanta played the clip of the 1989 Calgary Flames team winning the Stanley Cup. Terry Crisp was the head coach of that team, and of course he'd won a Stanley Cup with the Philadelphia Flyers. But I'm pretty sure, and I just sort of started to do this 2 minutes. I do my show prep 2 minutes before we go to Eric, Greg, apparently. I just had a quick little glance at all the teams that have won the Stanley Cup since 1989. I'm almost positive, and hit me up on Twitter, at Jeff Merrick, if you know otherwise, that 1989 Calgary Flames team, which is such a remarkable stat, the 1989 Calgary Flames team was the last team to win the Stanley Cup that didn't have any Stanley Cup winners on it. You know how rare that is? You know how difficult that is to win the Stanley Cup without at least one guy? I mean, the Pittsburgh Penguins won the Stanley Cup a couple of years ago. They had Ruslan Fedotenko on this. Like, everyone has a Stanley Cup winner on the team. Someone you turn to and say, what is this all about? How is this with a guy that's just like, okay, you know what? It's okay. This guy's done it before. We know what this is all about. But that 1989 Calgary Flames team, I think, was the last team to win the Stanley Cup that didn't already have a Stanley Cup winner on it. And that's all. Okay, your points now.
Fixing the Caps. How do we fix the Caps? Bill Dillon writes in, I never thought I'd say this, but trade Ovi. He cares about is beating Crosby. If Crosby isn't around, he's got nothing to play for. Bring in a character guy that can motivate the rest of the team. Maybe like Rick Nash? I don't know. R.M. Okay. Cooper. Could you imagine Ovechkin in Columbus? R.M. Cooper, I wish there was a simple answer for fixing the Capitals, but I'm not sure that there is. I've always thought the last few years the problem, quote-unquote, was quality players in the bottom top six forwards that weren't cutting it. But then they went out and addressed that, and theoretically the additions of Ward, Halpern, and Brouwer, they added veteran defensemen, goaltending, and everyone's clamoring for them to get as well. So he's kind of – the one thing they shouldn't do is make a Coburn for Zhitnik-type trade that kills the franchise for years just to end up in the playoffs for five games, is what he says.
You know, Brad Spencer brings up a great point and couches it with a time machine reference. I like this. Build a time machine, draft Malkin first overall, and find Mike Green a new groin. The issue about Malkin is an interesting one because I can remember talking to a couple of scouts, specifically 2004 NHL entry draft. Ovechkin goes one, and Malkin goes two, and a lot of the scouts said – Right now, Alexander Ovechkin is the better player, but if you look at who has the higher ceiling, it's Malkin. And for the first few years of their career, it will look like Alexander Ovechkin is far and away, you know, the better player out of the two Russians. But by the time the careers are all wrapped up, we all estimate that Yevgeny Malkin will have been the better player and should have gone number one. Is it kind of trending that way, Greg?
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, it's... based on Malkin being in beast mode this year and Ovechkin having regressed, it seems that way,
well,
right?
So that's the thing about drafting too, is you don't necessarily always want to draft who the best 18-year-old is, but you want to sort of, and this is the hardest thing about scouting and drafting, is you project what's this guy going to be like at 25, what's this guy going to be like at 30. Man, that's hard, but all those scouts, I think you nailed it on this one. Looks like Malkin's going to end up being the better prospect than Ovechkin.
Tom Lee, how do you fix the Washington Capitals? That's possible. Assuming it is, I'd have to go with Dale Hunter learning which statistics are useful and which ones aren't. If plus minus is now a stat to use for healthy scratches, Ovechkin and likes minus six should warrant a few healthy scratches. And hey, Semin looks like a beast with his plus five, definitely warranting his $6.7 million this year. And then there's another email I wanted to read from Nick Graff, who of course is a Flyers fan. Don't fix the Capitals. Their failure is funny. Then again, the wheels are starting to fall off in Philly. Obvious answer, trade Ovechkin for a boatload of players and picks.
Trade wow. Ovi.
Oh, Daniel Dahl-Smith. Take the C away from Ovechkin so he only has to worry about scoring goals and trade Semin. You're a big fan of taking the C off Ovechkin, aren't you?
But here's the problem. If you take the C off of Ovechkin, because I just think that he was a better player when all he had to worry about was being a player. Like, doesn't he strike you as the kind of guy who's just going to excel when he can just be a player? Like, just go out there and play, Alex. Don't worry about leadership. Don't worry about the room and grooming the guys and all that. Just go out there and be an awesome hockey player. Doesn't he kind of strike you as that guy? Like, has he embraced a certain level of maturity that you think is becoming of a captain? I would say no, but that's fine. Like, you don't all have to be that kind of hockey player. I just think Ovechkin's best when all he has to worry about is being the awesome Alexander Ovechkin. The problem is, if you take the C off Ovechkin, who gets it? Because the guy that I would give it to has now been healthy scratch for four games.
This is from Mike Behrens. Culture and urgency level changed when Bruce Boudreau came. Dale Hunter and GM get axed. I think McPhee's probably safe for another season, but I don't think if the Capitals don't make the playoffs, Hunter's going back to junior. There's no way he's coming back, is there?
Don't you kind of get the feeling that he's going back anyway?
Regardless, actually.
Well, here's the problem. Like, if you're Alexander Ovechkin, and we'll just focus on him because he's the big guy there. He's the big dog. Like, here comes Dale Hunter, and it's only a 1 year with an option. He's coming out of the London Knights of the Ontario Hockey League, and all of a sudden, here's this guy who's coming in. Sure, he's a former Washington Capital, a former NHLer of some distinction, and he's telling you what to do. And you're saying to yourself, hang on a second, I got $124 million in this pocket. I have the owner in that pocket, and you want me to do what, Dale? I'm in charge here, thank you very much. Because Bruce Boudreau tried to go to war with Alexander Ovechkin once upon a time, right, to get the quote-unquote most out of him. How did that end up for Gabby?
Yeah, well... And ended up with him going across the country to sunnier environs. Before we get to the greatest trade never made today, update on Rick Nash. This is courtesy of Larry Brooks in the New York Post, who confirms that the Rangers have had preliminary conversations with Columbus about Rick Nash. The Post has been told the opening asking price for Nash, the thing that was rumored, the Dubinsky, Chris Kreider, and a first-round draft choice.
Not even close. Not enough. No way.
Yeah, that's what they. That was the opening asking price, and this is what Brooks.
Hang on, the asking price. That's what Columbus wanted. If Scott Housen asks for that from the Rangers,
hold on. It's an excess of that. Is what Brooks is saying. It's an excess of that package.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe that Columbus GM Scott Housen, who scouted the Rangers-Flyers game in Philly on Saturday and presumably will be at the Garden on Sunday when the Blue Jackets face the Blue Shirts, is not demanding that Derek Stepan and or Ryan McDonough be included with Kreider in the package going the other way for Nash. McDonough's, they've got to get a defenseman in this deal. I mean, you can't trade Rick Nash and not get either a goaltender or a defenseman back, right?
You have to get one or the other. Yep, nope, I agree with that 100%. Yep.
And all due respect to the Rangers, why would you trade Rick Nash and not get a blue chip goalie back the other way? That makes no sense.
Well, that's why I said right away, too. That's why the obvious ones to me are Boston and Vancouver. I like your dark horse of the Los Angeles Kings because all those three have a goaltender to offer, and that's the one thing the Columbus Blue Jackets need desperately. So it's got to be Tuca. It's got to be Corey, or it's got to be Jonathan. One of those three guys.
The Capitals have two. The Capitals could give you one of two.
No, but they're not in that. They're not in the Rask category. They're not in the Schneider category. They're not in the Bernier category.
No, they're not. They're not as...
They got to stop 100-footers first.
That's mean. All right.
You're rubbing off on me now. I'm just getting nasty.
The greatest trades never made. Today's episode, right. Jeff Merrick. It involves a player we discussed yesterday.
Again, you know, I might be able to, because I can't think of a player, like a franchise type player who's been more traded more often than Vincent LeCavalier. So let's do another one, shall we? This is when, the Florida Panthers were, openly, shopping and ended up moving to the Vancouver Canucks, Roberto Luongo. And there was, you know, Nikolaj Habibulin had left Tampa and the Tampa Bay Lightning were scrambling to get a goaltender. They knew that Florida would never do a deal with them. But Jay Feaster had conversations with David Nonis of the Vancouver Canucks that went something like this. Dave, if you make this trade with the Florida Panthers and you get Roberto Luongo, but he won't re-sign with you, because let's not forget, Roberto Luongo was still very much of the mode, I'm building a house in Florida, this is my wife and family are going to be raised, I still want to stay in the state of Florida. So if there was any discrepancy whether he's going to re-sign with the Vancouver Canucks or do a contract extension, Jay Feaster let it be known that if you're going to let go of Roberto Luongo because you can't sign him, give us a call and we can talk. And the one piece that they were looking at dangling was Vincent LeCavalier. And then Los Angeles Kings jumped into the mix. And then how would this have looked for the Los Angeles Kings? And then how would this have looked for the Tampa Bay Lightning and change that dynamic all around now? Feaster had a conversation with Dean Lombardi that went something like this. Dean, if you end up getting the goaltender and he won't resign because he wants to come to Florida, I'll do the deal right now. You get Luongo, send him back to me, and I'll send you Vincent LeCavalier. And this is when L.A. was looking for a cup. Remember they had that year where they went through like a million goaltenders? So on the one hand, you can understand why Dean Lombardi wanted the goaltender. On the other hand, they also needed the big horse centerman right down the middle. So how would that change the balance of power should Luongo have been traded by the Florida Panthers to Los Angeles right back to Tampa Bay? But again, none of it happened. Trade never happened. Ever and again, yeah. I mean, there's another
the thing. The Vinny thing would have been like Baby Gretzky. Like he was a good looking dude going to L.A., centerpiece of the team. Yeah.
Yep. Totally
fun.
True. But again, it's again.
What a fun little feature.
It's, I could do another Vinny one tomorrow if you want. I mean, there's another big one out there.
By the way, do you realize how many Habs fans like were tweeting me last night just shitting their pants about
the breaking
up of the franchise trade that almost went down for Vinny? That was pretty cool.
It was funny because I was on Edmonton radio yesterday, and right before I came on, Bob Stauffer was on Oilers Now, was talking about, you know, the three pieces, you know, like looking at, you know, team to team and what pieces are absolutely unmovable. You need to hang on as your core of your franchise. And he's talking about the Montreal Canadiens, and he's making the point that, you know, everyone is available. You can trade everybody. The only three pieces you need to build around are Carey Price, PK Subban, and Max Pacioretty. It's like, dude, those dudes were out the door, ladies and gentlemen. You would have had, Vinny LeCavalier. So hot. Sorry to scare everybody about that trade yesterday, but again, never happened. Never happened.
Exactly. More greatest trades never made tomorrow. We may at some point, upon request, revisit the Stamkos Rangers trade at some point this week. Because I know that's something people like to talk about. All right, but that's the show for today. I'm Greg Wyshynski, Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick from Sportsnet. Tonight we'll be doing, speaking of Tampa, I'll be doing the Ottawa Senators-Tampa Bay Lightning game. Who's with me today? John Shannon and, hey, Brian Lawton. There you go, and Brian Lawton's with me, so I'll bug him about stories. So Brian Lawton and John Shannon with you is truly doing the Ottawa-Tampa Bay game.
Hey, real quick before we run out of time here, and this is unfortunately something that we probably should have done earlier in the show, what'd you think about AHLer getting 2-game suspension for tweeting that the Foo Fighters are the Maggot Fighters, as he wrote on Twitter.
Justin Fontaine. Had to be done. My only question then becomes, at what point do you start really coming down and policing that word on the ice?
Yeah.
Does that qualify as a private forum or a public forum? Because,
right,
ladies and gentlemen, that word is used every single shift.
A gay slur is used now and again on the ice during these games. It's very true. My takeaway from it was two things. First off, I think the Wild acted so swiftly as a reaction to the well-publicized, at least here in the States, Roland Martin situation, where Martin, a CNN commentator, was suspended by CNN after making homophobic jokes about a David Beckham Super Bowl ad. And he said it on Twitter, and then GLAAD jumped in and made a lot of noise, pressured CNN. CNN suspended him. So I think the Wild saw the writing on the wall, like, oh, my God, this is out there. We're going to catch hell. Let's just be proactive about it. Second thing is, you know what? These guys, AHLers, NHLers, everybody who's coming into the league now, it's of a certain age, they get training on this. They get training on it, and I think maybe this has to be included in the training, which is that when you think you're having a conversation with your buddy over something, it's actually being broadcast to a good number of people around the world, so be a little bit more wary. Because I do believe him that he was just joshing with his friend. He wasn't trying to be horrific to a group of people. But he said something that maybe could be said in the privacy of a room, but not broadcast to the world, and therefore was lambasted for it. So
you know, and you,
better
you know the better you training. Know the wish from working in the industry. I mean, it's much like a microphone. There is one rule that the one thing that you always assume when you're around a microphone, assume it's hot. Like assume that microphone is on, whether you're wearing a lav or you know you work with microphones that we're working with right now, whether you work with a Telefunken U47, assume that microphone is always hot. That's a sort of rule from Twitter. The other thing about Twitter, too, that I really believe, the more and more that I see people commit social suicide on it, man, Twitter needs to come with a breathalyzer. If there's just some way you can come up with a breathalyzer for Twitter, the whole world would be – well, it wouldn't be as fun. I'll give you that one wish. But, man, a lot of people would save themselves a lot of pain and anguish if Twitter just had a breathalyzer. Like, before – like, you know when you enter, like, your email address and your password? If there was, like, something, like a little tube that came up and you had to blow into it, it's like, sorry, we're not letting you tweet. It would you'd feel bad at that time because, oh, boy, someone's – pissed me off on the internet. I better take to Twitter right now. But in the morning when you wake up, you'll say, you know what, Twitter, you knew best. Thank you for
what you're essentially arguing for is the breath of life phone. You're arguing for a phone where you have to blow into it. Like a car. Yeah. Like after you've gotten a few DOIs, you have to blow in the thing to operate the car.
Correct.
You have to
correct.
Blow into it to ensure that A, you don't drunk tweet, B, you don't drunk text or sext. Yep. And then C, you don't drunk dial your ex on the when you're at the back of the bar. So I think your idea is a great idea. I will write it down. I will mail it to myself, and therefore I will then copyright the idea for both you and I.
Oh, for both you and I. And hang on, this is
my
idea.
Well, no. You had a brainstorm, and then I built off it. We are Watson and Crick, and I am Crick. What did they invent, Watson and Crick?
I am
DNA. They invent DNA.
Yeah, they invented DNA. Yeah. Deoxyribonucleic acid. Yes, they invented that wish.
Now we're getting all catchy.
See?
Yeah, that's right. Ribosomes and midichlorians. Midichlorians. Mitochondria. Midichlorians are Star Wars. All right, I got to get out of here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with another show, another marathon effort from Merrick versus Krzyzewski.
Hey, and here's something as well. You know what happened yesterday in the National Hockey League? A record was set very quietly. Ooh. Maybe not a record, but a milestone was set, and then this morning, it was crushed. You know what happened yesterday? And it involved the Washington Capitals.
Oh?
Yesterday, they called up Joel Reklish from the Hershey Bears, and he played. Today, they sent Joel Reklish down to the Hershey Bears, but for the period of 60 minutes, that was the Washington Capitals game yesterday. The last player ever to use a wooden stick appeared in the National Hockey League. Previous to him was Adrian Aucoin, but Joel Reklish had a wooden stick yesterday. You know, we were talking yesterday about Dave Grohl. And
we were talking about the purist. Who will be the Dave Grohl to get up in front of everybody at the NHL Awards? When Joel Reklish wins the heart, he would get up and say to the crowd, use wooden sticks. Don't use auto-tune.
I used it with a wooden stick, ladies and gentlemen. Where did it get me? A one-way ticket back to the Hershey Bears.
Down the Hershey Highway. And I could think of no better way to end a show on Valentine's Day than with that line. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will join you again tomorrow.
And here's the best way to end a Valentine's Day episode for you and your lovely, ladies and gentlemen, the late, the great, the Walrus of Love. Have a great evening.
Bye, everybody.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough. It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, babe.
Oh, babe.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Girl, I don't know why. Can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, some things I can't get used to. No matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel when everything is you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change, something rude. I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why. I can't get enough of your love, baby. Oh, no, baby. Girl, if I could only make you see and make you understand. Girl, your love for me is all I need and more than I can stand. Oh, well, babe, how can I explain all the things I feel? You've given me so much, girl, you're so unreal. Still, I keep loving you more and more each time. Girl, what am I gonna do? Cause you're blowing my mind. I get the same old feeling every time you're here. I feel a change, something moves. I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Oh, no, babe.
Baby, it didn't take all of my life to find you. But you can believe it's gonna take the rest of my life to keep you.
Your love, baby.